From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. In D. Keith Mano's new novel, Topless, a young priest gets caught up in his family's topless bar business and murder. Coming up on today's Fresh Air, a talk with Mano about spirituality and sexuality and what he learned about the topless industry while researching his book. Also today, sports writer John Feinstein takes us inside the world of professional tennis. It's the subject of his new book, Hard Courts. And rock critic Ken Tucker tells us about Living with the Law, the new release by Chris Whitley. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Representatives of labor and community groups demonstrated outside of President Bush's Kennebunkport vacation home today. The demonstrators are upset at his refusal to extend unemployment benefits. Alan Dowd of Maine Public Broadcasting reports.
The protesters said President Bush is wrong when he says the economy is improving and the unemployed don't need more help. Mike Cavanaugh represents the Maine AFL-CIO.
While the president golfs and fishes and enjoys the beauty of our state, we believe there's a real world in Maine and across the United States that he's seemingly blind to.
Groups from New York City, Long Island, and Philadelphia also sent representatives to the small demonstration. The protesters are especially upset at Mr. Bush's method for blocking the extended benefits. They call it hypocritical for him to sign the bill but not declare the budget emergency that would free up the funds. The president says it shows he still cares, but it also prevents Congress from overriding his decision. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Dowd in Kennebunkport.
South Africa and the United Nations agreed today on a plan that will make it possible for thousands of exiles to return home. The agreement would grant an amnesty for political crimes to an estimated 40,000 people who left the country to escape apartheid. The amnesty has been one of the African National Congress' primary conditions for beginning power-sharing talks with the white minority government. Foreign Minister Pik Botha stressed that the government will still retain the right to say who qualified for the amnesty. An ANC spokesman said the agreement was a good step, but said the government will still have to deliver on other promises. In Yugoslavia's breakaway Republic of Croatia, a helicopter carrying European Community ceasefire observers was shot at today. The shooting was part of continuing violence between Croats and Serbs in Croatia, despite a 9-day-old ceasefire. Jim Fish filed this report for the BBC from Zagreb.
Belgrade television reported heavy shooting, including mortar fire, around the town of Okučani, about 75 miles southeast of the capital, Zagreb. There were reported to be wounded on both sides. A helicopter carrying members of the European ceasefire monitoring mission, which was overflying the area, was hit by gunfire, but managed to land safely with no casualties. Until now, the ceasefire monitors have worked mainly in the neighboring breakaway Republic of Slovenia. But the apparent widening of the conflict in Croatia to this new trouble spot of Okučani may have prompted the observers to try to monitor the situation there at first hand. Further east, the first federal Yugoslav monitors visited the conflict areas near the border with Serbia. As they met local officials in the town of Sarvaš, shots were also fired, underlining the extreme fragility of the 9-day-old ceasefire.
Jim Fish in Zagreb. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 30 points to close at 2,968. This is NPR News. The U.S. Embassy in Colombia denied reports today that an American plane was hit by gunfire while flying over the prison holding drug trafficker Pablo Escobar and 14 of his associates. A Colombian radio station quoted official sources today in a story that claimed the U.S. plane violated a ban against flying in the airspace over the prison. The report said that the plane was fired upon by Colombian army troops as it attempted to take photographs. The U.S. Embassy issued a statement saying that the plane was a cargo aircraft that had engine problems while on a flight from Panama to a Colombian airbase. Israeli authorities say 2,600 Ethiopian Jews left behind in an emergency airlift will be flown to Israel in the near future. Patricia Golan reports that an agreement to bring out the remaining Ethiopian Jews was reached with the former rebels who toppled Ethiopian leader Mengistu Haile Mariam in late May.
Last May, over 14,000 black Jews were flown out of war-torn Ethiopia on a dramatic secret airlift. They flew on 41 military and commercial planes in a 48-hour operation. At one time, 28 planes were in the air. Today it was announced that the present Ethiopian government has given its approval to fly out those who were left behind. 600 Jews now living in Addis Ababa will be brought to Israel next month, and the remaining 2,000 Jews living in villages in the Gondar region in northeast Ethiopia will be flown first to the capital and then on to Israel. The arrangement is the result of negotiations which have been going on since the Operation Solomon airlift in May. The man behind that operation was Uri Lubrani, now Israel's leading negotiator for a Middle East hostage-prisoner exchange. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
Environmentalists in the oil industry agreed today on a federal plan that would require cleaner-burning gasoline in the nation's most polluted cities. A spokesman for the Environmental Protection Agency said the new fuels will cost motorists up to a nickel a gallon more. I'm Corey Flintoff in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain. D. Keith Mano has written that in his novels he tries to relate traditional Christianity to the concerns of the modern world. In his earlier books, his Christian protagonist's belief run up against issues such as progress, civil rights, pollution, and war. In Mano's latest novel, an Episcopal priest inadvertently ends up running a topless bar and is forced to look at his attitudes toward sex. Mano spent years researching his new novel, Topless. He conducted more than 300 interviews with topless dancers, club owners, bouncers, and customers. This journalistic approach to Mano's fiction comes from the many years he's written for magazines. In researching his articles, he's given blood with winos, tested $5,000 worth of sex equipment, and has bought lunch for bookies, cigarette smugglers, pimps, and Nobel sperm bankers. Keith Mano is the only person to ever appear as a contributing editor on the mastheads of both National Review and Playboy simultaneously. In his new novel, Topless, the priest, Mike Wilson, gets a call from his sister-in-law, Ethel, telling him his brother has disappeared. She wants Wilson to come to New York to run his brother's restaurant, The Smoking Car. Wilson leaves his parish in Nebraska, only to find out the restaurant is really a topless bar. I ask Mano to read a section of the book.
I have just come back from The Smoking Car, and we have trouble. I can't believe this. I just can't believe it. And Ethel shrugs it off. Good God, what am I dealing with here? Wait, from the beginning. I take the Lincoln and I head down to 60th Street and Northern Boulevard. I'm wearing my clerical suit because my cords are filthy and my jeans have a hole in them. I'm full of anticipation. I mean, can I handle this? Sure I can. A restaurant can't be harder to manage than a parish. Probably it's easier. They don't hold you responsible for souls, just for appetites. So, I pull up. It is the weirdest-looking place. Facade like the side of a Long Island Railroad passenger car. A dozen tiny windows set into silver metal. The name is written out in a flashy blue neon. It's at the west end of the block. There's an out-of-business dry cleaner at the corner and a hardware store to the right. I figure, well, they're just starting to serve lunch. So I take my little portfolio with my just-bought three-ring notebook in it, and I set out across Northern Boulevard like I'm about to take a course in human digestion. Naturally, it's so bright outside I can't see for a good few seconds after going through the front door, but I've got this big lasagna of a dumb smile on my face, like, hi, I'm the brother-in-law, welcome to the new regime, my people, and I see what? I see a naked woman. She's hanging down from a trapeze over a tiny stage. Jesus Christ, I am in a topless bar with my collar on. I turn around and blast into the sunshine across the boulevard into the Lincoln, where I proceed to eat my fingers.
This idea of taking an Episcopal priest from a parish in Nebraska and putting him in Queens, where he's managing a topless bar, are you playing with temptation here?
Yes, very much so, and Mike is very aware of the fact. He has good reasons to run this topless bar. You could make a case for him. His brother's disappeared, and his sister-in-law has four little children, and she lies to him and tells him it's just a restaurant, so he comes back to New York thinking, my brother put me through seminary. It's the least I can do to help out. These are my nieces. And he is, the surprise is sprung on him, as we've just heard. And suddenly he is confronted with, well, if I'm playing with fire here. The Lord is says, you know, lead me not into temptation, and so forth. He thinks he can handle it, but he knows. He knows there's a lot of danger to the soul there. And, of course, he's trying to hide his identity.
Do you know where this idea came from?
It came from, it's perfectly consistent with the other novels that I've written, in which I take a Christian and put him in or her in a tremendously pressured situation, like Vietnam, perhaps, or the ghetto, or my first novel, Bishop's Progress, dealt with a bishop facing medical miracles, and his how a Christian deals with modern science and so forth. But I've never taken the two poles of our reality, our spiritual pole and our sexual pole, and put them so close together so that sparks fly easily and naturally. It isn't hard to come up with exciting metaphors when you've got a priest and a nude woman in the same situation. So in a sense, I just put the two together and saw what fireworks would explode and what I could learn from it.
Well, it's interesting, too, because you've put Mike Wilson in a place that I assume that most preachers are going to preach against.
Indeed. And, of course, he's an Episcopal priest, which gives me a little leeway. The Episcopal Church is wonderful that way. It has all the smoke and incense, and it's also so open to what's going on in the world. There's a point, actually, where Mike brings himself to the murders occur in the bar, and someone suggests that he's... as a repressed priest, he might be the murderer. And he says, don't you realize Episcopal priests aren't repressed enough? By the time he actually offers to resign, the local diocese comes up with a group of people who stand up for his right to run a topless bar. And he says, wait a minute, I know the difference between a sin and a civil right. So although he is a preacher, he's a very with-it preacher, as so many of our preachers are these days.
Are you challenging Christians or believers? Do you think that most Christians have not been tested, in a sense, and that their faith is too easy for them?
Well, I think it's very important for us all to respect the power of our sexuality. So much of our creativity comes out of it. So much of our energy in a given day comes out of it. And like water in a leaky basement, if you block it up in one area, it'll pop up someplace else. And I think Christians too often are disrespectful of the power of their sexuality, and repressing it isn't the way to do it.
But isn't that what oftentimes the church calls for?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I'm known, I guess, somewhat facetiously as America's foremost Christian pornographer. We all have our niches, and I seem to have found mine. But it's partly because I feel, if you were to relate me to any other writer that I would feel comfortable with, it would be John Donne and his ideas of the spirit being a raping force. Lord, you know, take me. What better or what image do we have for the power of God's grace at all beyond perhaps the orgasm, which is our physical complement to the spiritual idea of being born again, coming to revelation, having a moment of great power where you're taken out of yourself.
You're saying that the sort of born-again experience, and that's almost become a cliché, is a kind of orgasm?
Well, I'm not saying that it's a kind of orgasm, but if you were feeling for a metaphor for it and something that other people would understand, it's really tough to come up with anything at all, maybe being hit by a truck, but I think the power that is in the sexuality, in our sexuality, has a perfect complement in the power that we have in our spirituality. That doesn't mean that they belong necessarily together. That doesn't mean that you don't have to be very aware of and respectful of the power and danger that is in our sexuality, because it can become obsessive.
Is that considered a rather heretical idea in your church?
Well, I tithe my income, so...
So you can say whatever you want.
Having received $500,000 for the movie rights, I have presented to my bishop. I'm not an Episcopalian any longer. I converted from that to Russian Orthodoxy some 12 years ago. My bishop says it's an interesting theological problem whether or not to accept the tithe money from an R-rated movie, but at least it's doing some good.
My guest is D. Keith Mano, and he has served as a contributing editor to both Playboy magazine and the National Review. He's written a whole bunch of books, and his latest book is called Topless. It's a novel. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with D. Keith Mano, and his book is called Topless. Are you now considered somewhat of an authority on topless bars?
I would think, distinguished as that position is in the world, that I might be the authority. But it's not easy because topless is such a pervasive industry, and there are differences in every state and locality. The one thing that is consistent is that it's a money-making proposition. Wherever it is, and it's getting bigger. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry. There's in Texas a topless bar called Cabaret Royale that was built for $8 million. It has corporate boardrooms in it and fax machines and Xeroxes, a three-star chef, valet parking, and you can overlook the dance floor while having your corporate board meeting. Things are changing.
Did you set out to be an expert? Was that your goal?
Not really. It was. There were a lot of topless bars in my neighborhood. I ran a cement factory in Long Island City, and of course, as a contributing editor to Playboy, I have done all kinds of pieces on sexuality. I've even lived as a transvestite for a period of time, and I'm always aware of our sexuality because it's part of my job and the way I make a living. And it struck me that nobody had written a really deep piece on all the aspects of topless. And I started to research it in the local bars and got to know people and became fascinated with the variety of girls who are working there. Let me say that in general they tend to be brighter, better educated, and much more interesting than the customers by a long shot. They're all girls of who are taking a certain amount of risk. Most of them are college educated or working their way through college, and they have tremendous stories to tell.
Do they call themselves and each other girls?
Am I being politically incorrect? Please,
no.
Please, the ladies at the bar. I don't want to get in any trouble. I just found out that being 5'4", I'm vertically challenged. So cover that one for me, if you will.
No, I think that some adult women call themselves girls and each other's girls, and it's a form of familiarity. So I'm not saying that you're wrong. I'm just curious if that's the language that they use.
Well, they probably call themselves dancers.
Mm-hmm.
They come, as I say, in great varieties. But what I like to try to get the reader or the listener to empathize with is what I call the great transformation. And it's something that... it's very hard to empathize with because it doesn't happen to you or to me or to it certainly very seldom happens to men. But imagine an 18-year-old girl who maybe, say, in 80% of the cases comes from a dysfunctional family. Maybe there's alcoholism. Maybe there's a divorce. Maybe there's a stepfather who's not been all that loving. And certainly there's not much money available to this girl, and she's been bullied by adults. She has no standing in the culture. She leaves home, comes to New York. A friend of hers says, "Geez, why don't you stop working in this clerical office and try dancing topless. I've been doing it, and she reluctantly, nervously, because she doesn't think that much about her body. She's not necessarily a very beautiful girl. Probably not big busted. Most topless dancers aren't. She goes in and tries it and steps on stage in fear and trepidation. I know one girl who passed out unconscious, fainted away as she made her entrance. She steps out there, and for doing nothing, for standing there and moving around and not falling down, dollar bills begin to fly out of the air, and it's men are listening to this young girl. Previously, men paid no attention. Adults paid no attention. Doctors and lawyers are listening to her every word. She's getting tremendous validation, both from men and in the form of money, and all of a sudden, she's earning $50,000 to $100,000 a year tax-free and is projected into the upper middle class instantly. That's hard for a girl.
Putting the money aside and looking at the kind of relationship between the dancers and the clientele, who has the power here?
It's an interesting point. I think the power is constantly shifted backwards and forwards. Money directs the power to some degree, so the male with the biggest tip will get to sit with and chat with the girl, but ultimately the power in a topless bar lies with the girl. She chooses who she'll spend the half hour between dance sets with talking.
I'm speaking with D. Keith Mano, and his book is called Topless. It's a novel, and it's about an Episcopal priest from a parish in Nebraska who comes to New York City to Queens to manage a topless bar for his brother who has disappeared. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled recently that totally nude dancing was not protected by the First Amendment. It was not guaranteed as a form of free speech. Where do you come down in this ruling, having spent so much time in a topless bar?
Well, I think the Supreme Court ruling is perfectly consistent with other Supreme Court rulings, which makes sense to me. It's up to the locality, I think. There always should be, and historically always has been, a red light district in most cities. The important thing about pornography, and as far as bookstores or theaters are concerned, or topless bars, is that they not thrust themselves upon an innocent public, but that there be a place for it to happen safely and comfortably. And as far as topless is concerned, I doubt if it's threatened by anything. It's just too big an industry at this moment. There's just too much money involved. There are, as I've found out through market research, 62,000 women dancing topless in America. Well, figure that out. That's Shea Stadium in New York plus a small theater as well. And maybe 750,000 women who have danced topless. 750,000 at some time in their lives in America.
Well, do you think these women and what they do somehow threaten the morals, the public morals and public order, which is kind of what the Supreme Court referred to?
I don't think it's much of a threat at all. It occurs in a relatively private area. As I've said, it is not in any way a front for prostitution or anything of that kind. I can't see how you could possibly make a case for it being dangerous in any sense. No bodily liquids are exchanged. It's not that different from the performance art that is being sponsored by the National Endowment. So that's not the problem. I don't feel it's an immoral thing. I feel it's a dangerous thing for the participants. It's dangerous because it trivializes feelings. It trivializes the relationship between men and women. Sometimes, if done too obsessively, if a man's only connection with women is his experience with them in topless bars, then he has a distorted picture of women, obviously. And for the women, as I've mentioned, the addiction to money and the addiction to attention and the perhaps disrespect for men that occurs because you can manipulate them so easily, these things are dangerous. But as far as being either a matter of freedom of speech, that I feel that's stretching it, and as far as it being a threat to the community, Well, it's been 25 years it's been going on and is growing and is no really that much different from a Las Vegas review.
Do conservatives think differently about sex than liberals?
It's an interesting issue. It's one of those circular things. If you're talking about First Amendment rights and freedom of individuality, very often you run into conservatives standing side by side with liberals. I have always been a libertarian in sexual matters and a conservative in virtually every other area, and I've written at length on pornography and issues of that kind for National Review, which is maybe not entirely comfortable with what I write, but is edited by one of the great men of our time and who's never changed a word of anything that I've written. And a case can be made that on both sides, that although promiscuousness and permissive sexuality is a threat to the family, as a conservative might state, yet, on the other hand, these freedoms are, to some degree, implied, if not guaranteed, in the Constitution. So it's an area where I have as many liberal friends as conservative friends.
So do you end up fighting with conservatives about sex and with liberals about everything else?
to some degree, but there are plenty of conservatives who feel that, I myself feel it's just not an issue that conservatives should be involved in when there are many, many more problems of much more serious import, like the invasion of our lives that the state has brought about, and the federal government's desire to regulate every part of our lives is much more important an issue, or foreign policy is much more important an issue, and that conservatives just get sucked into an area that's very dangerous and very confusing. The whole Mapplethorpe controversy, for instance, is a waste of an enormous amount of energy on the part of conservatives fighting something that is probably unfightable. It is free speech. It angers me, particularly in the areas where religion is attacked, where an artist is using the energy that comes from religion to give a false boost of a significance to his own art. Those kind of uses, which are purely cynical, are very annoying. But there are more important things for conservatives to think about than pornography or topless dancing.
Now, this Mike Wilson character, he's alive and well in your next book, is that right?
That's right. It looks like it's going to be a series, and one in which Mike is sent to various places as a kind of a troubleshooter for the diocese, and gets to learn more and more about his sexuality and his feelings towards various social phenomena, homosexuality, and other things, and there will be a murder mystery element in all of them, I guess. And I enjoy writing him. I don't in general like writing much at all. It's a painful business, but Mike's voice is natural to me, I guess, and it's been a real pleasure creating him. He's younger, he's handsomer, and he's taller than I am, so I can live a vicarious life through him.
Well, thank you so much, D. Keith Mano, for joining us today.
The pleasure was mine.
D. Keith Mano's book is called Topless. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moskowain with Fresh Air. Not too many years ago, even a fanatical sports fan didn't pay much attention to tennis. No longer. Now tennis players are huge stars, and television pays millions of dollars for the rights to the top tournaments. John Feinstein's followed those changes. He's a sports writer and a commentator for Morning Edition. Coming up, John Feinstein talks about tennis in the 90s. And rock critic Ken Tucker tells us how Chris Whitley keeps us guessing with his new album, Living with the Law. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush says that he will block a bill to extend unemployment benefits. Mr. Bush said that he is sympathetic to the plight of the jobless, but cannot support the $5.2 billion measure passed by both houses of Congress. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold has more on the story.
To stay within the constraints of last year's budget agreement, Congress passed legislation to help unemployed workers, but hinged the funding on the declaration of an emergency. President Bush today agreed to sign the bill, but said he would not declare an emergency, which means the funding would be withheld.
It's pretty hard to say to someone that's out of work, hey, things are getting better. They're not necessarily getting better for their families. And when you have difficult economic times, you're faced with difficult economic choices.
Congressional leaders called the move cynical and heartless. House Speaker Tom Foley said another unemployment compensation bill will be sent to the president in September, one that he'll either have to sign or veto. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
Environmentalists in the oil industry have agreed to support federal rules requiring cleaner burning gasolines in the most polluted cities in the country. A spokesman for the Environmental Protection Agency says that motorists in the affected areas will pay up to 5 cents more for a gallon of gasoline for the year 1995. Under these proposed rules, some of the main goals of last year's Clean Air Act are defined, but the regulations will not become final until November, after time for public comment. In Lebanon, a leading Shiite cleric has charged that Washington is not exerting enough pressure on Israel to free Arab detainees. But as John Devitt reports for the BBC, Israeli officials continue to say that they want more answers about the fate of Israeli servicemen missing in Lebanon.
Israel appears to be content for attention to switch away from its role in the hostage negotiations. Israel's defense minister, Moshe Aaron, said he thought that the level of expectations had been blown out of all proportion. And Israel's chief negotiator, Uri Lubrani, made it clear that he was prepared to wait for those holding information on Israeli servicemen and Western hostages to make the next move. Mr. Lubrani said he didn't expect anything to happen overnight. Israel has set out its position for the next stage in the process. It's prepared to release some of the prisoners it holds in return for unequivocal information about 7 of its servicemen listed as missing in action in Lebanon. Mr. Lubrani said he hadn't received any new information during his meeting with the Secretary General. The Secretary General, he said, had understood and accepted the Israeli government's position and was now acting in accordance with it.
John Devitt reporting for the BBC. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 30 points to close at 2,968.02. This is NPR News. Officials at Harvard say that an international AIDS conference slated for next year will be moved out of the country because of a government ban on AIDS-infected travelers. A rule barring AIDS-infected individuals from the United States was imposed 4 years ago, but was suspended temporarily during the conference last year in San Francisco. This morning, President Bush defended his administration's AIDS policy by saying it's a good, sound policy. The conference in Boston had been expected to draw 15,000 people from 120 countries. Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts begins a week-long trip to Vietnam and Cambodia tomorrow in search of new leads on Americans missing in action from the Vietnam War. He told reporters today in Bangkok that if the Bush administration is serious about resolving MIA cases, it should lift its economic embargo against Vietnam. Mary Kay Magstead reports from Bangkok.
The Bush administration has said it will not lift its 16-year-old economic embargo against Vietnam until there is fuller cooperation on resolving cases of missing in action Americans. Meanwhile, American companies are barred from doing business in Vietnam. Senator John Kerry says this is not the best way to get new information on MIAs.
If you want to quickly begin to provide yourself greater access to information, by God, the best thing you can do is get everybody you can into the country and be able to have a commerce and exchange not only in goods, but in information.
Kerry has led a call in the Senate for the U.S. to lift sanctions as soon as possible. The embargo comes up for renewal next month. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Bangkok.
Industrial production moved up in July for the fourth month in a row. The government says production was helped by a rising output of cars. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. It wasn't that long ago that tennis players wore white, played the game with wooden rackets, while fans watched quietly and applauded politely. Tennis is more boisterous now and more popular. A top tennis player can earn anywhere from a couple of $1 million to $10 million a year from tournaments and corporate endorsements. And you're as likely to read about Jimmy Connors, Martina Navratilova, or Jennifer Capriati in a gossip column as on the sports page. John Feinstein is a sports writer and will be covering this year's U.S. Open for World Tennis Magazine. He traveled with the players in the 1990-91 pro tennis circuit and has written a book about on-the-court play and behind-the-scenes deals. It's called Hard Courts. I spoke with Feinstein about the sport and about John McEnroe, whom Feinstein says exemplifies what is best and worst in tennis.
I think that McEnroe is one of the most honest people I've ever met in sports. Whether you like him or not, what you see is what you get with John. There's no phoniness there, unlike with someone like Andre Agassi, who will say whatever someone puts in his mouth at a given time. John says what he thinks at all times. Clearly his talent is as great as anyone who's ever played the game, and yet he's never grown up. He's never come to understand, you know, the old theory about two-year-olds who, as they grow older, they realize that they are not the center of the universe. John has had trouble dealing with that notion. I think he's gotten better now that he has his own children. But like many tennis players, he really thinks that he is the center of the universe. And if somebody does something wrong, it's directed right at him. I once was talking to him about umpires, and I said, you know, they make mistakes, but you know they're not out to get you. And he said, oh, no, they are out to get me. Mm. They make mistakes, but make no mistake about it, they are out to get me. And he really believes that.
He is a remarkable player and plays with such intensity and finesse, but he doesn't look like he's having fun. He looks like a kind of joyless player.
Well, I think you can say that of most of the players of this generation, to be fair to John. I mean, Yvonne Lendl isn't exactly a bunch of laughs out there. And in the last couple of years, neither has Boris Becker been. I think Boris was when he first came on tour, when he won Wimbledon at age 17. But I don't see a whole lot of chuckles out there among the players these days. But you're right in that I don't think John has gotten a great deal of joy out of his greatness. And that's too bad. And I think now, only now, in his 30s, he's 32 now, is he realizing what he had? Mary Carrillo, the commentator who grew up with John in Douglaston, made a great point, I think. She said that it's a shame because he didn't appreciate his genius until it was gone.
In the old days, professional tennis players would get money when they won, and that was how they made their money. How does money work now in tennis?
Well, to be fair, there have always been under-the-table payments in tennis, going back to the Australians in the 1960s when they were supposed to be, quote, amateurs, unquote, and they would get appearance fees for going to certain tournaments, but you were talking $200, $400, something like that. Now the way it works is that most top players will not step on a court in a non-Grand Slam tournament, the Grand Slams being the Australian, French, and U.S. Opens and Wimbledon. And almost any other tournament before a McEnroe, a Lendl, an Agassi, a Becker will play, they will get a guarantee up front. In other words, you show up to play, you're going to get X dollars no matter what round you lose in. The guarantees can go as high as $300,000 for a single week. Many of the players who go to Japan, it's such a long trip, demand that kind of money. Yvonne Lendl has a standing rule that for every 10 hours he has to fly to play in a tournament, his appearance fee goes up by $50,000. So that when you read in the paper that Yvonne Lendl won $70,000 for winning the tournament this week, well, that's really not true. He got $150,000 or $200,000 just to show up, regardless of whether he won the tournament. And it's really a sham that's being carried out on the fans.
When did players begin to wear product and corporate logos all over their shirts?
It's something that's evolved over the last 15 years. Somebody first had the idea that if you put a logo in the right place when a match was on television, that the TV cameras would be forced to show it. Obviously, you see a tennis player's arms all the time, so that was a logical place to start putting patches. As a result of patches proliferating, the people who run the game, both the International Tennis Federation and the Men's Tennis Council and later the ATP, made rules on how big the patch could be and where it could go and how many you could wear. But players still look like mini billboards when they walk out there if they're big enough stars that corporations are willing to pay for their arms.
Well, do companies pay X number of dollars for an arm versus a shoulder versus the back?
Well, it depends, again, on what the deal involves. A deal, for example, Jennifer Capriati last year had a two-tournament deal with Texaco at the French Open in Wimbledon just to wear a patch, okay? And she was paid $100,000 just to wear the patch for two tournaments. She then made a different deal with Oil of Olay, which involved television commercials and endorsing the product and wearing the patch, that was a multi-million dollar deal over a period of 5 years. Now, Jennifer Capriati was 14 when she made the deal. I don't think her mother was old enough to use Oil of Olay at that point, and yet she was endorsing the product.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with John Feinstein. He's a sports writer, has written a number of books about a variety of different sports. His latest one is about tennis. It's called Hard Courts, Real Life on the Professional Tennis Tours. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Sports writer John Feinstein is my guest. It seems to me that in women's tennis, that women's tennis players get more coverage than most female athletes of other sports. Would you agree with that?
I think so. I think that women tennis players have come as close to being considered equals with their male counterparts as in any sport, because of people like Chris Evert, because of the Billie Jean King-Bobby Riggs match and the attention that women's tennis got there, because of all the money that Philip Morris and Virginia, and through its subsidiary Virginia Slims, put into women's tennis in the 1970s, and because of the Evert-Navratilova rivalry, women's tennis has received far more attention than almost any other women's sport.
Do women players talk about the kind of pressure on them to not only play well but look good on the court?
Some of them have. Carling Bassett, who was John Bassett, the millionaire sports investor daughter, talked very honestly about it. She was a bulimic and an anorexic, one of several in women's tennis over the last few years, and she has talked very openly about fighting the disease and about the pressure to look good and about the pressure to be thin. And she thinks that to some degree, everybody models their daughter after Chris Evert, because Chris Evert was always the pretty girl next door, quote unquote. Zena Garrison went through the same thing. She said to me, you know, we go out there in short skirts to play all the time. Well, if you're overweight, your legs aren't going to look very good. And so there's tremendous pressure on you in terms of being marketed, and these women are marketed to look thin and look good.
Do you think Martina Navratilova's revelation, the fact that she's a lesbian, has that hurt her at all as a player?
No, not as a player. I think that sometimes it has hurt her as a person because she's very sensitive, and when the crowd is against her, the crowd was almost always against her when she played Everett. The crowd has always been against her when she plays the younger players as they're coming up. That hurts her. She can't understand why someone who has been as great a player as she is, has always been a gracious winner, always been a gracious loser, has not gained more appreciation. She's gained some. I think people have come to respect her over the years, but it's been very grudging, and I think that hurts her. It's hurt her in endorsements. She doesn't make nearly as much money in endorsements as a player of her caliber would make if not for that revelation, and she is the first one to admit it. But I don't think it's ever hurt her as a player.
You're saying that the crowd is against her because she's a lesbian?
No, I can't say that. I can't go and talk to 19,000 people. But over the years, historically, she has never been the crowd favorite. Now, is that because she's a Czech-turned American? Is that because she plays such an aggressive game? Is that because she's gay? I don't know. But I do know that over the years, she has never been the crowd favorite and that she's very sensitive to that fact.
I'm speaking with sports writer John Feinstein, and we're talking about professional tennis. You say that Andre Agassi is rather disliked by other players on the tennis circuit. Why?
Because he's not real. I think that, for example, McEnroe, who may upset people with things that he says at times, they know he means it. They know that whatever John says, it comes from the heart. Agassi will say whatever will sell products, whatever his agent, whatever his coach, whatever his brother, who is omnipresent in his life, tell him is the best thing to say at that particular moment. And I think players resent that. They think he's fake. Tennis players, athletes in general, don't like people who are fakes.
I've watched him play, and I must say, with his fancy clothes and his long hair, that when he's winning, he looks great. But when he's losing, somehow those clothes and that great haircut makes him look silly.
They start to look silly, don't they? And at the biggest moments is when he tends to play his worst tennis. He's been in 3 Grand Slam finals and hasn't won any of them. Of course, Yvonne Lendl lost his first 4 Grand Slam finals and went on to become a champion. And Agassi may yet do that. He may outgrow this phase and realize that it's more important how you play and not what you wear. His shirts are tailored literally so that they're shorter in the front so that whenever he hits a forehand, they come up and people can see his stomach muscles.
Really?
Oh, yes. He insisted that the shirts be designed that way.
Well, I'm in shock. I'm trying to recover myself. What makes Wimbledon the premier tournament still? After all these years?
Well, there are a number of things. The tradition obviously has a great deal to do with it. Wimbledon is unique because it's played on grass. None of the other major tournaments are played on grass anymore, whereas in the past, 3 of them were. Now only Wimbledon is. It's played in a small private club. The stadium itself is much smaller and much more intimate than any of the stadiums where the other Grand Slams are held. The presence of royalty in the box every day gives it Wimbledon an aura that none of the other tournaments have. Wimbledon is the only tournament that does not sell off every inch of space to corporations to put their signs up. So there is a throwback feeling when you're at center court at Wimbledon that this is how tennis used to be when they didn't play for big money, when they weren't all wearing corporate logos all over their arms. The club still insists that players wear white. Even Agassi wore white this year when he finally just deigned to come back to Wimbledon. So Wimbledon is like in another era of tennis. It's almost a complete throwback, and I think people like that. It's a nice change from the other 50 weeks of the year when everybody's chasing every buck they can find.
Do you think it'll stay that way?
I do. I really do. Wimbledon makes a lot of money. Don't get me wrong. I mean, it's not like they're not in the 20th century. They make a lot of money off of television. They market their clothes and their equipment very well. And there's no reason to believe that they're going to have to change.
Wimbledon allowed cheering this year. Isn't that right?
Well, Wimbledon never didn't allow cheering. It's just that it's so difficult to get a ticket to Wimbledon that most of the people who do are the kind of rich type of people who aren't apt to get too enthused. But this year, because of the weather, for the first time ever, they played on the middle Sunday. And since there were no tickets printed for that day, they just let anybody who lined up, and many thousands of people slept overnight in the street to get in, anybody who lined up got into center court. So you had a completely different kind of crowd. You had kids and teenagers and people who were just thrilled to be inside the gates of Wimbledon, probably for the first and in many cases the only time of their life. And they just had a great time out there.
Well, I heard players saying that they loved it.
Oh, well, absolutely. Because it was different. And it was what they're not used to at Wimbledon. But I promise you, if it was every day for 13 days at Wimbledon, the players would say, gee, I wish the crowds would be a little bit less rowdy. You can be sure that whatever happens in tennis that affects the players, eventually they'll want it changed.
You say the U.S. Open is the tournament that everyone loves to hate. What makes it so awful?
Well, there are a number of things. The facilities, which are going to be redone and rebuilt in the next few years, are the least adequate of any of the Grand Slams. There aren't enough practice courts. The locker rooms are too small. Obviously, with New York traffic, just getting two in the courts can be a nightmare. In 1986, John McEnroe and Peter Fleming were defaulted from a doubles match because they got stuck in traffic on the Long Island Expressway. For a fan, it's a lot of fun because there's electricity everywhere. But for the players, it can be a nightmare because everything is hard. Everything is inconvenient. And when you're in the same place for 2 weeks trying to win a Grand Slam tournament, you want everything to be easy.
You also say that that the U.S. Open is run by CBS TV.
I don't think there's any question. The U.S. Tennis Association has really sold out its authority to run the tournament to CBS. Because CBS pays so much money, they are allowed to dictate the schedule. They tell the USTA who they want on the stadium court and when, who they want playing night matches. The U.S. Open is the only major tournament in the world that forces the players to play singles semifinals and the final on back-to-back days. Every other tournament has women's semis Thursday, men's semis Friday, women's final Saturday, men's final Sunday. So there's a rest day between the semis and final for everybody. Because CBS wants that so-called Super Saturday with the two men's semifinals and the women's final tucked in between, there's absolutely no semblance of rest or reality for the players. The women's final of the U.S. Open is the only major sporting event where the players wake up that morning not knowing what time the match is going to begin. So how do they prepare? And they're playing a Grand Slam final. They could go on court at 2 in the afternoon or at 5 in the afternoon.
Are you a tennis player?
A bad one.
Well, I was wondering if you've covered all these players, whether you've ever played tennis with them.
No. You know, one of the things that you don't do when you cover professional athletes is try to inject your life into theirs. Because, first of all, they're not interested. They really aren't. And I've always felt that my contact with them, the time I spend with them, is because they understand that I have a job to do. And for me to impose my brand of tennis on them would probably be like them imposing their brand of writing on me.
John Feinstein, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
John Feinstein is a sports writer and commentator. His book about professional tennis is called Hard Courts. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about the show today. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Marty. We have news today about President Bush and the extension of unemployment benefits. He is against it, won't sign it. Also, more on the perils of Salomon Brothers and news that the two top officers say they're ready to step down over this weekend in light of the scandals about their dealings with federal treasury bills. We'll also be talking with the main advocate for Detroit's all-male inner-city public schools, reacting to yesterday's court judgments, saying that girls must be admitted, and Noah Adams on the comic book heroes X-Men.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Living with the Law is the debut album by singer and songwriter Chris Whitley. Rock critic Ken Tucker says it's exceptional for the first time out.
Brother running powder money, daddy somewhere on a drum, in the hours after washing, I do my dreaming.
It is increasingly rare for a young musician to emerge as fully formed and idiosyncratic as Chris Whitley has on Living with the Law. He even manages on that title song to overcome the macho melodrama of an outlaw's self-pity, and he does it by reducing his voice to an exhausted moan. Instead of hearing a boast in his words, you sense his despair. Even when Whitley reaches to create a kind of anthem, as he does on Big Sky Country, he does it in a close, intimate style.
Now when this is over, over and through, and all them changes have come and passed, I wanna meet you in the Big Sky Country. I just wanna prove, mama, love can last, yeah, like hallelujah in the Big Sky Country, just like forever and ever is wild.
Whitley frequently plays a national steel guitar with a bottleneck slide. That and his knack for stating the hard details of his lyrics with a flat vehemence helps him to achieve a mixture of blues, folk, and rock that keeps a listener off balance. You never know where one of his melodies is going to veer off to next, when another verse is going to rush ahead of a chorus, when he's going to move beyond a murmur to a wail. It's easy enough to pick out Chris Whitley's influences. This is one young fellow who spent the 80s with the radio turned off, holed up with a stack of Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters records, with maybe an occasional Johnny Winter or Allman Brothers tape for the car. Once or twice here, he's mannered and overreaches himself, as when he gets a bit florid impersonating a tough dude on death row in Phone Call from Leavenworth. But Whitley is an honest overreacher, free of irony. He's made one of the most interesting albums of the year. And the nice thing is, you can't tell what year he thinks that may be.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. We'd like to hear your comments about Fresh Air. Give us a call toll-free at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's show was produced by Fred Landerl. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Terry Gross returns next time. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.
Nothing wrong with staying inside. There's nothing wrong staying home tonight. All week long was a world of restless. Whatever it takes for a little peace and quiet.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, writer Lee Grove talks with us about his new novel and about blowing the whistle on the Harvard University English department. Also, filmmaker Paul Mazursky tells us why he cast Woody Allen and Bette Midler in his recent film, Scenes from a Mall. That and more on the next Fresh Air.